From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Never Again was a great commitment, and it didn't last long. Forged in response to the Holocaust, the promise stood not only as a reminder of that great tragedy, but as a vow to prevent genocide from happening again. Then came Bosnia and Rwanda, and now it's widely charged Darfur. Young eyes across the country have been watching the killing in Sudan. Students watching the glaringly ineffectual response of the international community to large-scale rape, murder, and displacement. And they're doing something about it. They've created the Genocide Intervention Network. It's a youth-powered group that hopes, with dues and letter-writing campaigns and privately financed boots on the ground, to stop the rape and killing and shame Washington into acting. They are young and idealistic. They are also savvy and determined and testing the limits of citizen action in the face of genocide. This hour On Point, saying never again, again, with a new generation of activists. You can join the conversation. If the U.S. can't or won't, and the U.N. can't or won't stop a genocide, can a citizen's crusade actually do it? Are you inspired to try again with a new generation? What's waiting for them out there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin this hour in Sudan with Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent based in Khartoum. He's been following the latest surge in violence in the Darfur region. Jonah, thanks for being with us. What's the scope of the surge and why?
Hi, Tom. Well, it's been an increase in violence over the last month or so in Darfur. There had been a fairly long period of relative stability there, but in the last month, there have been a series of attacks and clashes occurring on almost a daily basis in Darfur. Attacks on refugee camps, attacks on villages, and open clashes between the rebel movements that operate in Darfur and the Sudanese government. Exactly why it's taken place now is difficult to say. It may be connected to the fact that peace talks to try and resolve Darfur's problems are taking place in Nigeria, and there are a lot of groups who feel that they should be involved in those peace talks who aren't, and they're now flexing their muscles, if you like, in Darfur to try and make a case for themselves being involved in any future peace agreement.
Jonah, run us through the numbers, if you'd be good enough. The number of dead so far in the couple of years now that this has gone on, the number displaced in the camps there in Darfur, the number of peacekeepers who are trying to keep some semblance of order.
Well, the first thing to say is that though this war has been going on for 2.5 years, no one has yet come up with a definitive total for how many people have died in this conflict. I think the UN estimates about 180,000 people. Some people from a distance suggest that it's a lot more than that. The simple fact is that nobody really knows. Darfur is a vast country, a vast area, and it's very hard to know exactly how many people died in which areas. There's about 2 million people displaced in Darfur. They were driven from their homes by militia conflict and clashes, and they're now mostly living in overcrowded camps in Darfur, being fed and provided water by the international aid community. And then attempting to bring some semblance of order to all this is the African Union peacekeeping force, which has been deployed in Darfur. There's 6,000 of those peacekeepers. Darfur, of course, is a vast area, and many people say that those 6,000 are really a drop in the ocean, as they cannot possibly see most of the things that are going on across the arid outback of Darfur.
With this surge in violence in recent weeks, the UN is reported to have evacuated many of its personnel. What portion of the UN presence has been pulled out, and what kind of NGO presence remains? Who's helping these 2 million displaced people?
Well, the UN had a difficult choice to make. Quite a lot of Darfur at the moment is what they call a no-go area, which means that the roads are simply too dangerous for the United Nations aid workers to operate. So in one of the major areas in Darfur, that's West Darfur, the United Nations decided to pull out all their non-essential staff, as there was simply nothing that they could do there. Everyone in West Darfur is confined in the regional capital, El Geneina. So effectively, the decision has been taken in a few select areas to pull out all those people who aren't absolutely crucial to the aid operation and put them in safer areas. At the moment, the United Nations aren't panicking. They say that they've got supplies on the ground in various places which can try and cover this situation in the short term. The worry is if this violence continues in the long term, if these aid agencies can't get back into these camps and areas, that over the next weeks and months there'll be people who simply start running out of supplies.
And finally, Jonah, there in Khartoum, you know, with the people watching from front row seats, give us your interpretation. What is going on with this violence? Why? What's the reason for it? And why hasn't it been stopped by international pressure over all this time?
Well, why hasn't it been stopped because of international pressure? I think the simplest answer to that is that the international pressure on the Khartoum government simply hasn't had any effect. The Khartoum government has signed a lot of agreements promising to rein in militia in Darfur and to try and bring order, but simply that hasn't happened. They haven't honored those agreements. That's plain to see by the fact of the violence that's still going on. The situation has also become a lot more complicated over the last year or so, because there were two main rebel groups who initially started an insurgency in Darfur, which the government and militia then responded to, and those two rebel groups have now fragmented, making the situation a lot more complicated. People don't know who to go to attend the talks, who to go to deal with on the ground, because there are so many different groups on the ground who've got their own agenda, their own leaders, and who respect different agreements that have been signed. So what we've seen over the last 3 months or so, 3 months, 6 months, has been a fragmentation on the ground. Of there's really nobody who anyone can go to and try and strike a deal, because there's no guarantee that then those people will keep that agreement.
Jonah, and this really last, we're talking with young people today in the United States trying to bring pressure and direct action to bear to stop what's going on there, to stop genocide. You've said to a producer of mine, you're not sure this is genocide. After everything that's been said publicly, why do you say that?
Well, genocide is a word that was said last year by Colin Powell, of course. It's not a word that has been repeated by the United Nations. They sent a commission of inquiry here to investigate whether they believed it was genocide, and they came to the conclusion that it wasn't. Saying it's not genocide doesn't necessarily absolve the Sudanese government of any blame or responsibility. In fact, lots of horrible things have taken place in Darfur, and the Sudanese government bears a lot of responsibility for that. There are a lot of war crimes have been committed. There have been ethnically related incidents on the ground. But whether it actually amounts to genocide is something which you'll find that most of the people here in Sudan are not willing to say. The United Nations, most international countries don't put their head out and say it's genocide. What they say is that they believe war crimes have gone on here, and that there have been great atrocities committed. The real question is, if you say it isn't genocide, does that lessen the need to do anything about it? And I think that's something which people around the world say, well, if it's genocide or not, that may be a semantic question. What the real issue is, what can be done to improve what is quite a desperate situation on the ground?
More than enough killing, that's clear. Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent in Khartoum, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Joining me now in the studio in Boston is Mark Hannis. He is founder and chief executive of the Genocide Intervention Network. It's based in Washington, D.C. The idea for the network took shape while he was a student at Swarthmore College, where he graduated this past May. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
Also with us in the studio, Rebecca Hamilton. She is a joint degree student at the JFK School of Government at Harvard and at Harvard Law School. And she's co-founder of the Darfur Action Group at Harvard, now affiliated with the Genocide Intervention Network. Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. There's a lot we want to understand. Let's begin, Mark. Genocide Intervention Network, what is it? What's its goal?
Sure. So we started at the Genocide Intervention Fund, and we're just changing right now to Genocide Intervention Network. But our goal is to provide the tools to citizens here in the United States and elsewhere to help protect civilians in the face of genocide.
Why is it needed?
It's needed because, first of all, nothing's being done. Right now, as you just heard, there's a debate about, is it genocide, is it not genocide? Sometimes they talk about the International Criminal Court or ad hoc tribunals. But no one is really talking about, how can I help save lives? And the most important thing, no one tells us citizens when we watch TV and we read about all the atrocities, then we ask the question, what can I do? And no one's really helping us answer that question. And that's why we created Genocide Intervention Network.
Rebecca, what can you do that Colin Powell and Kofi Annan cannot?
We can do a lot. After every genocide, every Bosnia, every Rwanda, the analysis comes out 2 years down the track. Where was the noise? It looked like the public didn't care. We know that people care, and we can give them the tools to show that they care to their political representatives that can give them the strength to use that political liability and move forward.
Such as? What kind of leverage?
The political leverage that they need to know that it's going to count in terms of their vote calculation. If I know as a representative that I've got 4,500 dues-paying members who care and who are watching me see how I'm voting on genocide legislation, that's going to make me more willing to go ahead rather than just take the default option of it's happening somewhere else and the American public don't care, so what's my incentive for doing anything?
Mark, are you anyone would be inspired by this, and we'll hear more about how this pulled together and what's been done already. In the end, are you dreamers or doers? Have you made any difference in Darfur yet?
Not yet, but we're happy to say that this month we've raised $250,000, and we're looking to give an initial installment of $150,000 to the African Union. And one of the most likely possibilities will be to support female civilian police officers. So yes, we are making a difference.
So directly, your group, never mind what the government's doing, you'll pay to have female officers protecting women in Darfur from rape and death.
Gang rape, which is being used. Rape is being used as a weapon of genocide. So exactly, that's something that's not being addressed as much as it should be. So that's, we are results oriented.
It's inspiring to see a new generation stepping up. It's also fascinating to consider exactly what citizen action can and cannot do. We're saying, or hearing it said, never again this hour with a new generation of activists against genocide. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Is this the way? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're saying never again this hour with a new generation of activists against genocide. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Can a new generation pick up the torch and do something different, something more effective about genocide? If the U.S. can't or won't, if the U.N. can't or won't do it, can a citizens' crusade stop the killing? Can a 20-somethings' crusade do it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Mark Hannes. He's founder and chief executive of the Genocide Intervention Network, was the Genocide Intervention Fund until very recently, just graduated from Swarthmore College. Also joined by Rebecca Hamilton, co-founder of the Darfur Action Group at Harvard University. And she has worked to leverage
divestment.
We'll hear about that from the powers that be, that may be related to Khartoum's imperviousness to international pressure. You all have an ad in the works that,
yes,
I think speaks to what you're trying to do here, to put this back front and center in front of the American people. This is a 30-second ad you're trying to get aired on national television. Is
exactly
that right, Mark?
Exactly, yes.
Let's listen to, you've asked who to put this on. Who said yes, who said no?
We've asked all the major networks, so Fox, ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN.
And CNN says maybe soon?
CNN says maybe soon. Fox has said no.
Here's the kind of public message that these young people are trying to get out to the whole country. Let's listen.
Well, they show us this.
Michael Jackson's lawyers rested their case.
This.
Filed criminal charges against the so-called
runaway bride after faking her own abduction.
And this.
But some are wondering if the engagement of Tom Cruise
with actress Katie Holmes.
This is happening. You can't stop a genocide if you don't know about it. Genocide is news. Tell the media to be a witness.
Tell the media you want it. The message from the young and the this that's happening, which you can't see there, is the death and rape, the killings that go on practically every day in Darfur. The men on horseback or camelback come over the ridge, and it happens. And it's happened again and again for the last couple of years. Rebecca Hamilton, Mark Hannes, and the network of young people that they're a part of is trying to do something about it. For some perspective on this, I want to turn to Samantha Power. She's a professor of human rights practice at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. She's currently working as foreign policy fellow for U.S. Senator Barack Obama, Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Samantha, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
What do you make of 20-somethings raising money to put some more African Union guards around the camps to try and put an ad on television to mount a letter writing campaigns with politicians in the United States? You've been at this a long time. Does it make a difference to you when 20-somethings step up and pitch in or not?
Well, I think it would make a difference if 20-somethings, if teens, if 50-somethings. I mean, noise is the one thing that gets the attention of policymakers. I mean, from the standpoint of the Bush administration, you look at Sudan right now and you think, oh, we just catered to our Christian constituency in this country and secured a North-South deal. That is a peace deal between, you know, the Sudanese government and rebels in the south.
And this is quite apart from the Darfur situation.
Totally apart from the Darfur. So you're thinking, this is going really well for us. We need Sudanese cooperation in fighting the war on terrorism. Bin Laden hung out in Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
We need to improve our ties. And then there's this pesky problem of a genocide in the western part of the country. If you're the Bush administration and you're thinking in terms of national interest, you just want Darfur to go away. And
they want it to go away because they want Sudan's oil, they want its help in the war on terror, something else, all of the above?
All of the above. I mean, ultimately, you know, states are going to pursue their economic and their security interests, and Sudan, cooperation with the Sudanese government is seen to pursue or seen to advance those interests. But then there's this genocide, and there are people certainly within the Bush administration who you know, have seen that up close and want to see it stopped. But they would have a very hard time getting traction if not for the noise that has been made by the students, by Christian groups actually in this country as well, by Nick Kristof of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And that noise in turn has translated into a very, very vocal constituency within the U.S. Congress, both on the House side and the Senate side. And I just got down here to Washington, and I didn't really know exactly how it worked
mm-hmm.
up on Capitol Hill, but they really do count the letters. They really do count the phone calls. And that doesn't translate into then, you know, a meeting, a crack last-minute meeting of the cabinet where George Bush says, okay,
yep.
you know, we're going to go and stop genocide. But what it translates into is an inability of the Bush administration to privilege national interests and not think about domestic political interests. Because what these kids have done, students have done, and kids, actually, because they're high school and middle
mm-hmm.
school kids, believe it or not, who are teaming up with them,
mm-hmm.
Is created the perception that there is a domestic political constituency to do something about this. And just about everything that has come out of the U.S. government so far has been the product of this kind of pressure. The envoy, John Danforth, who was appointed to mediate the North-South conflict, the use of the G word, which was mentioned by your
mm-hmm.
correspondent in Sudan, which was back in September of last year.
Well, first the House of Representatives and then Colin Powell both saying genocide.
Exactly. And so the House and the Senate resolution that precipitated the State
mm-hmm.
Department's use of the word grew out of, again, phone call after phone call, these green bracelets that the Darfur Action Group and the Genocide Intervention Network have circulated widely, and other Darfur groups. You see members of Congress, members of Kofi Annan's inner circle wearing these green bracelets saying, not on my watch or never again.
Mm-hmm.
You see them sort of floating around Washington in a very strange way. The humanitarian aid that's been supplied, which we tend to poo-poo because it's not a political response to what is ultimately a political problem, but more than half of that aid is supplied by the U.S. government, and there's been no hesitation about continuing to fund, you know, the refugee camps and to keep them afloat. There'd be many, many more deaths if it weren't for that. The increase in the African Union troop deployment, which was grossly insufficient, of course, given the scale of the problem, that would not have come about if not for U.S. funding. That funding would not have come about if not for this noise. And perhaps most dramatically, the referral of the crimes that occurred in Darfur to the International Criminal Court, a referral that the Bush administration said it would make, a referral from the UN Security Council to the court of those crimes, and the Bush administration said, we will not make this referral over our dead bodies. You know, we do not want to legitimize the International Criminal Court. The pressure was so great from constituents that the Congress basically signaled to the Bush administration, the Republican Congress, you've got to let these crimes be prosecuted. We've got to steer these crimes to this court, even if it means holding our nose while we do so. And then just one final point, because this is the most tangible thing that they have done, and Rebecca and Mark deserve incredible credit for this, but there have been actually no tangible sanctions imposed against the government of Sudan for its crimes in Darfur, except the divestment that has occurred on university campuses. So in a funny way, they've kind of bypassed government and imposed their own mini sanctions on companies doing business in Sudan, namely PetroChina, which has tried to exploit oil fields in Darfur as well as southern Sudan. So I think this is quite a list. It's not, unfortunately, yet tipping the balance against the genocidaire and against the atrocities, but it's something we've never seen before in the face of genocide.
And under a flag carried by very young hands. Samantha Power in Washington, stand by. I want to dive into this with Mark and Rebecca right here in the studio. And I know you each have a very personal interest in this. Rebecca, that you've been there in Sudan, very up close. Mark, the grandchild of four Holocaust survivors, a family scattered to the corners of the earth by the Holocaust of World War II. There's a very personal connection for you here that goes right into your own family. But here's what I want to put to you, because we want to hear how you're thinking about this. Mm-hmm. Samantha has described some of the dynamics of why this hasn't been solved. In your own words, I want to hear from each of you, how do you see, what is the nut of resistance to this genocide being stopped, and how do you plan to crack it?
I think the nut is there's no lack of, so it's not lack of information. We know what's happening. There is actual report that came out that said 400,000 people have died, not the UN's 180. It's not a lack of resources. We definitely are providing, as Samantha mentioned, a lot of support for the African Union, a lot of support for aid. The big problem is a political will. They don't face any cost for an action. It's okay to not do anything.
And they being, in this case, Khartoum, Washington?
Washington, our public officials, mm-hmm. our representatives. It's okay to do nothing and then say, I'm sorry, afterwards.
Okay, let me ask, in your view, what would Washington do, that would stop this?
They could largely support the African Union. They're right now penny-pinching them.
You mean they'd put in, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands more African Union troops?
There's right now, as Jonah mentioned, there's about 6,000, but we needed to have at least 15,000. Romeo Dallaire, who was in Rwanda, has used 44,000.
Would the Khartoum government accept that?
Well, right now they've accepted the African Union.
Would they accept 50,000 more?
They probably not.
So does that mean unseating the Khartoum government? Are you saying that's necessary?
Not necessarily. I mean, right now the African Union is there, and they are expanding to 7,000. So why don't we just ramp it up?
That's expanding by 1,000. It's a different thing for a government to accept. I guess what I'm getting at is how big a challenge is the U.S. and you, by extension, are you up against? Will the Khartoum government accept the kind of actions that would be required to end this genocide, your word?
I think they have to. I think looking at the other conflict, as you mentioned, the North-South Peace Agreement, where John Danforth, where the U.S. really put a lot of effort into helping solve another genocide.
Took 20 years.
It took 20 years, but when the U.S. really went behind it, when John Danforth stepped up to the plate, they really helped seal the peace.
So you're saying it's money from Washington to put more African Union troops in and to pressure the Khartoum government to accept that?
I think if there's a will, there's a way. Once the will is there, then the resources, the money, the diplomatic pressure, all that follows. If they're really serious about stopping genocide, and the amazing thing is that it wasn't just the House of Representatives. This was both houses of Congress. First time ever called it a genocide while it was happening. Colin Powell, President Bush has called it a genocide. And we have signed and ratified the Convention of Genocide. And this is where it's personal, where after the Holocaust, never again. Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia. It just keeps on happening.
And we've called it genocide and it goes on.
But we've made a commitment. We signed it. It's the law of the land that if we see a genocide, we will do all in our power to help stop it. And yet we're being wimps on genocide, as Christoph calls it.
The voice of youth says step up and do it. Rebecca, you've worked specifically on divestment. And that was aimed not at an American corporation, but at a Chinese corporation. Why? And can the United States alone, when there are other actors, big ones like China, fix this?
Well, these companies are trading on the New York Stock Exchange. The amazing thing about running a divestment campaign is it gives just regular citizens, just students like us, the ability to sanction the government of Khartoum directly.
Explain what you did and why it worked as a sanction.
Basically, it costs money to fund a genocidal campaign. And at the moment, the government in Khartoum are getting that money from the corporations that are doing business with them. Now, in the U.S., at the universities and their endowments, across the states in state pension funds, there is support for those companies. We want to pull American money out of those companies.
You went after one, PetroChina. Why?
That was one that Harvard University, which is where I'm at, had $4.4 million worth of the shares in, and they divested because
of
student pressure.
What's the impact, the role of PetroChina in Sudan? Sudan is one of the countries that China's kind of tried to tie up as an oil source, am I right?
Correct. So they've got oil interests, but there's other companies beyond PetroChina. Siemens, Alcatel, there's others that can be targeted. The point is that we can directly sanction, put economic pressure on the government of Sudan through our actions as individuals here in the States.
So you're remembering the apartheid campaign and saying if enough divestment mounts up and corporations become unwilling to go into Sudan, then the money dries up for the government and they can't fund
right,
this genocide.
Exactly. You have to force corporations into this choice. Do you want to lose your reputation and finances in the U.S. market, or do you want to continue to help the government
of
Sudan?
How widespread is that divestment in PetroChina right now? Harvard did it. Anybody else?
Right. So Stanford has also taken divestment. Yale and UCLA are looking at it. They're getting close. Harvard is sort of being a model, I guess, for them. It's like the standard has been set. If Harvard can do it, then why not everyone else? And in addition, the state of Illinois has divested state pension funds. We're looking to do the same in Massachusetts.
Do you really think you're going to, with these pinpricks, maybe they're more than that, are you really going to get China to step aside when its energy interests are at stake? Is it really going to decouple from the Khartoum government?
It's not just a case of just one company. It's not just a case of PetroChina. But if you look at the bulk of them, if you can get all of them to that tipping point where it's costing them too much to stay in Sudan, then yes, I think that makes a difference.
And Mark, your organization has moved from this widespread kind of thing that grew almost organically. Lots of students wanting to do something. Mm-hmm. You stepped up and said, here's what we can do, you and others. People have rallied around that. Now you've moved to Washington. You're a 501c3. You're in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
In a sense, you're another NGO.
Mm-hmm.
There
are a
zillion NGOs in Washington. So is it a good thing that you've moved down among the thousands and thousands of NGOs, or does it mean you're just part of the establishment now?
I think we're different because there are not thousands of NGOs that are focusing on genocide, and one of the things that we're doing is we're creating a lobbying group in addition to the nonprofit, which we can really raise the temperature on politicians. Like Senator Lugar, for example, he is not bringing this current legislation to committee. So they can't pass this legislation that's going to impose sanctions, that's going to impose asset freezes, travel bans, and support the African Union if he doesn't bring it to committee. So there's one person from Illinois who is not feeling the heat, and
Indiana.
That's by going
mm-hmm.
In Indiana. So we're working right now with students from Notre Dame and other colleges in Indiana. We're trying to contact congregations, Jewish, Christian, Muslim in Indiana to raise the pressure on Senator Lugar to get this legislation up to committee.
Young voices bringing on the heat. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get one call in here, if I may. Jonah is calling from Washington. Hi, Jonah. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to thank Mark and Rebecca for their excellent work. And I also wanted to say that, you know, as a 30-something, I look to the older generations and I see that a lot of the frameworks that have been set up to resolve these kinds of problems are failing. And we throw a lot of money at them, both, you know, the United States and most Western countries, especially, you know, Norway, Scandinavia, all these countries, they're just dumping tons of money into resolving conflict around the world. And there's really, I don't want to say there's not much being done, but there's not enough. That money is not being somehow spent effectively.
Can young people encourage something to happen that 30 and 40 and 50 and all the rest haven't?
Exactly. And what I see is like, hey, I'll, as someone who's really getting into the workforce, starting to make money, I'll invest my money in these younger kids.
There's a link at our website. Great. I guess you can actually do that. Join as a dues-paying member. Is that right, Rebecca?
Correct. Go to genocideintervention.net, and you can sign up and become a member of the first permanent anti-genocide constituency.
Or onpointradio.org, and you'll find a link there. Mark, do you really believe you can do something that 30-somethings, 40, and the rest haven't, can't?
I think the bigger question is how can we not do anything? We've got 400,000 people that are dead. Genocide has continued from the Holocaust after we said never again. We must do something.
Samantha Power, we hear the passion right here, and it's just from a different generation. Does that make it different?
Well, I think to some extent they were better positioned, perhaps, than the rest of us to just look more dispassionately, ironically, at the last decade of events. And they looked at Bosnia and they said, well, there was an intervention in Bosnia. Was that because it was victims that looked like us, or was it because the New York Times ran
two full pages every day, and, you know, columns by Anthony Lewis and William Safire and so on, you know, or was it because it was Europe and closer to NATO? And they kind of, you know, they looked at that, and then they looked at Rwanda, and they said, you know, 800,000 people died there.
We'll do something sooner here. Samantha Power, Mark Hannis, Rebecca Hamilton, we'll take a short break here. We're talking about a new generation saying never again. Again, what do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Will it work? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new generation of 20-somethings standing up against genocide, first in Sudan and Darfur. You can join the conversation. Are you heartened to see an attempt at direct action on genocide by the young? Do you think it will work? And what do you hear yourself thinking as you listen to the idealism of these young activists? Can they make never again stick? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Washington by Samantha Power, now working in the office as a foreign policy fellow for U.S. Senator Barack Obama. And in the studio by Rebecca Hamilton. She was with the Darfur, co-founder of the Darfur Action Group at Harvard. And by Mark Hannis, founder and chief executive of the Genocide Intervention Network, now based in Washington, D.C., and pulling a lot of these threads together. Marianne is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Marianne. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to congratulate the students for coming up with a very specific and innovative solution that addresses safety, because I think safety has to be first.
And you're talking here the guards they want to put on the ground at the camps for women in Darfur.
Yes. All these other problems that lead to the fact that there seems to be no shortage of dictators and tyrants throughout history and throughout the world today. We have problems with poverty, that it seems as if anybody can be recruited to work for these people because they're so desperate. They have food problems, certainly sanitation, education problems.
And here's a real response to those, and you're saying congratulations for getting specific and for being innovative. Marianne, thank you very much for your call. Rebecca Hamilton, where does it stand, this push for the Genocide Intervention Network to actually fund female guards on your dime in Darfur, protecting people, protecting women there? How close is that to happening?
Very close. I mean, the money's there. We are in direct contact with the African Union. It's absolutely going to happen. And I just wanted to say, Marianne is right on point, that there's no point going with food aid if you haven't got civilian protection right. Safety has got to come first. Food aid is going to be no use
if you're dead
civilian.
The food doesn't matter.
Exactly.
If you rape, you may not want to eat.
And right. When you're seeing the UN pull out its staff because they can't even feel safe in the area, that's even more a reason that we need to focus on civilian security. We need to focus on protection first.
Mark, is there a precedent for a private group like yours reaching right around all the government apparatus and directly hiring the African Union to go in and be cops on the beat here?
Not that I know of, but I want to make it clear we're not hiring them. This is not a mercenary army. The African Union is an international organization. It is endorsed by the UN Security Council, and we're supplementing it. The money that they need, they're facing a $220 million shortfall. We've raised a quarter of a million. This is something that we're sending a signal to our governments that they need to feel ashamed, that they have a responsibility, and that citizens above our tax dollars have to go and help raise money to protect the people of Darfur from genocide.
You say you're not hiring, but if it weren't for this money, those extra boots wouldn't be there.
Right. I mean, we're supporting, it's going through the African Union, so it's not, they have their mandates, they need to respect all the other rules of engagement that the African Union has. So we're complementing what governments are doing. We're not replacing them.
But we hear a lot about in the 21st century, you know, national governments may be supplanted by communities of interest who form over the internet or through colleges, whatever, and reach out and do things directly. you're saying that's a piece of this, but it's also, this is agitprop. This is an effort to shame when kids have to put up the dollars to fund the guards so women don't get raped.
Exactly. And this is where the idealism meets the realism. We're not just about making noise. We're actually about seeing results. And this is how we've thought this out. We know that this was a big issue. It's, again, in if it was the Holocaust for my grandparents, sending in bags of rice wouldn't have stopped the gas chambers. We needed to send in people who would provide security. And this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to see results and focus on what's needed most.
Lauren is calling from Toronto. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi there. Well, it's a very interesting discussion, but it seems to be a bit about you're dancing sort of with words about death. Samantha called it a pesky problem in Darfur. You've called it the G word.
Well, we're saying genocide straight up, and we're putting a number on it.
Right.
Where are you taking us, Lauren?
Well, I'm taking you to some. Rebecca said that the sanctioned the government of Sudan directly. If you think the genocide is sort of like the or whether it is or not, it's like murder in the first or murder in the second. If you want to get to the government, my point would be if you look at the history of Sudan. It grew into independence in the 60s. For two-thirds of its existence, sort of current government regime, it has fought two-thirds of its people, the South, for two-thirds of its life. So my point would be, you can do stuff on the ground, but we don't. We can pressure our UN ambassadors to vote. Where they're not even elected officials, but if this group wants to get action, they can get on the UN ambassadors. Line and try to, my suggestion would be reinstate the trusteeship council that was put aside in 94.
You're saying take sovereignty away from Khartoum.
Exactly. It's a bankrupt government. There has to be a mechanism to declare a government basically insolvent in a humanitarian way.
Lauren, we've got it. We thank you for your call. Mark, how far are you willing to go with this? Are you willing to say, U.S., U.N., this government won't stop it, take away sovereignty, go in and stop it, we can't have another Holocaust period?
No, I think we need to make sure that we're going through the right process. I mean, right now, the International
Criminal Court... But Lauren says, Schma says, people are dying.
Right.
And this government has proven it's willing, and it has proven. It's
willing
to go for years in defiance of the international community. You're the grandchild of people who escaped a situation where millions died while people talked about process.
Mm-hmm.
So?
Right. I mean, right now, I'm focused on especially the Janjaweed who are committing these crimes of genocide in Darfur. And so I do agree with Lauren. I think we do need to take a harder look at the current government in Khartoum. They're clearly not stopping what they're doing, and we're not putting enough pressure on them to stop doing. So I do think we need to take a harder look instead of, for example, flying their Minister of Information over to Langley, which is what we've done. We need to actually be stronger at them, and if that entails some of them leaving positions of power, then so be it.
How old are you now, Mark?
I'm now 23.
And you, Rebecca?
I'm 28.
28. So you're moving to Washington, you're talking about following the process, you're 23. How long are you willing to wait before you look at this more radically, as Lauren would suggest?
I am actually looking at it more radically now. I think the focus, the way that we're changing the terms of the debate to focus on civilian protection, and we're focusing on, we need to disarm the Janjaweed, we need to get these government gunships to stop flying over and bombing the villages. I'm saying we need to look at it now. And one of the best ways to start is by saying civilian security is the number one issue. What is the way that needs to get that to happen? And that includes sanctioning the government, travel bans, asset freezes. These are things that are going after the specific individuals in power in Khartoum.
Samantha Power, you're in relative terms an old hand at this game, relatively. So how do you see this? Is this a new, I mean, and you're on the advisory board of the Genocide Intervention Network. You're affiliated with it. Do you see this as a new tool, a reinforcements coming over the ridge? What do you see in a youth movement to supplement what you've worked long and hard on?
Well, there's been this gap between the kind of latent constituency that we think exists in the United States of people who have been influenced by the Holocaust, by the idea of never again, a gap between that passive constituency and then policymakers who again and again have invoked the American people as the reason they are not putting much on the line to stop a Rwanda or to get involved in Bosnia.
Because Americans don't want to.
They're forever, politicians are forever saying that. And so, to some extent, what Mark and Rebecca and all the other students have done is they are stripping the U.S. government of its alibi, which is that the problem is the American people. They're also, as you know, as the African Union effort indicates, showing, you know, look, if a group of 20-somethings can raise $250,000, why can't the U.S. Congress really put up real money in order to strengthen the African Union? The trouble that we're sort of bumping up against now is that Iraq, of course, has changed the political framework or the political parameters in which we're even having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is one actor among many on the international stage. It is the most powerful actor in terms of military and economic might, but it doesn't have the same pull and the same ability to gather countries together and get those countries to adopt the U.S. agenda that it might have had, you know, even just 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think Mark and Rebecca and the others have done is they have gotten the Congress exercised. The Congress, in turn, has forced the Bush administration to make this, to put this very high up on the list, I mean, much higher up on the list of things to do than it would be otherwise without this noise. But then the United States gets to the table and it says, okay, you know, allies on the Security Council, and it, with some sincerity, sometimes it's half-hearted, sometimes it's
mm-hmm.
sincere, you know, let's impose these asset freezes, let's impose these travel bans, and those other countries are pursuing their national interests. They want to do deals with Khartoum,
right.
They want to exploit those oil fields, and they don't have genocide intervention networks in their countries creating the same kind of political pressure. So part of the question for that Mark and Rebecca will be dealing with will be, how can we make this a global movement in the way that the apartheid movement became a global movement, so that Sudan can't, you know, turn its back on the United States and then turn to China, to France, you know, and even to Germany. And how are those African Union troops going to get $100 million from someone other than the United States? Because European countries have been very cheap in terms of actually, you know, lending their support to this problem. So, you know, the United States is quite isolated. It doesn't have the legitimacy that it might have had, at least in some circles, 5 years ago, to say, hey, there's a genocide, you know, let's do something about it. And it needs to burden share because it is so overstretched, you know, politically and, of course, militarily.
Mm-hmm. Global citizen pressure as the goal to be built there. And yet, of course, genocide works with a clock because this isn't, I mean, apartheid, as bad as it was, this is killing and large-scale
exactly.
killing that goes on. Ben is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Ben, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was saying that good luck for Mark and
Rebecca here.
Rebecca.
Yes,
but I have to say, as a Congolese Tutsi who was here in '92, trying to get you know, the State Department and everybody else in Washington D.C. to do something about the genocide in Rwanda, where I lost many relatives, I have to say that I don't have very much hope about the United States or Europe, for that matter, to go and intervene in Africa.
Why not, Ben? Why not?
Because there has always this attitude of Africa as a lost continent where there is a grain of racism. That has to be really put in, on the table.
Ben, your line is very rough, but I think we've got the nut of it. Mark Hannes, here's Ben. A Tutsi. He was very concerned about Rwanda. He saw what happened there, 800,000 dead. He says racism ultimately is going to be a check on acting here. So, you know, once again, we turn to you in your youth. You're 23 years old. You bring that fresh passion to the table. Are you concerned that at the end of the day you're going to run into the same kind of thing that's disillusioned Mark here about intervention?
I don't think so, and I think it's important. While this is a student movement, it's what we've seen from non-students as well. There are piano teachers that are giving us all their proceeds for 2 weeks. Some a piano teacher in Salt Lake City, and it's people from middle schoolers who came to D.C. to help lobby with us, all the way to 80-year-olds who are helping write their members of Congress. I think people know that we're looking at not just the symptoms; we're looking at try to address the root cause causes of genocide and try to address the structural changes. And I think that, that looking at racism is, while, yeah, it is a factor, it's not, it's too easy to sort of say it's just racism. This is an issue of political will. It's an issue of narrow interest of the way we look at Sudan and just looking at the North-South it's more than just the moral interest. There's an economic and a security interest of why we should get why we should be more involved in Darfur, and we're not looking at that right now.
For the United States, of course, interests there as well. Dean is calling from Falls Church, Virginia. Hi, Dean. You're on the air. Hello, Dean. Are you there? Oh, looks like we lost Dean. Let's get one more. Marcia is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hello, Marcia. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I want to put this in historical perspective. First of all, I want to commend the students and tell them to keep doing whatever they're doing. Because what happens if they're not successful or if we don't stop this genocide is shows itself in the Armenian genocide in 1915, where the world was informed about what was happening, but for geopolitical reasons, didn't do anything about it, and as a result, 1.5 million Armenians died. And 90 years later, the Turkish government is denying it still.
So, talking about decades, almost a century going by, you're happy to see a generation standing up and naming and framing this one. Marcia, thanks for your call. Rebecca, is there something about youth itself that's helpful here? Do you look at it afresh and say, wait a minute, something can, will, must be done? And are you afraid that that's going to run into a reality at some point? You'll become, you know, one more member of the jaded elders.
No, I mean, I think it's starting as a student movement because we have been able to look historically and see what hasn't happened in the past and have the kind of insanity, if you like, to go on and say this can be different and make it happen. And I think with persistence, that absolutely can happen. We're looking at it structurally differently. We're not just another NGO who's giving great policy advice. We're linking that and making it politically costly for action not to take place.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mark Hannis, do you feel your grandparents who fled the Holocaust over your shoulder as you work on this?
I definitely think so. My one grandmother who's alive, she's very proud of what I'm doing. So I think this is a great message. And one thing that I just want to tell all callers and anyone who's listening is that this isn't just about us doing this. We need your help. And to please go to genocideintervention.net and join as a member, because that's exactly how we are powerful. It's because of people like you that are giving us money and signing up as members and writing those letters.
We've just got a minute. Look down the road, maybe, I don't know, a decade. Hopefully Darfur is well settled by then. But this isn't just Sudan and Darfur that you're focused on.
No, we're looking at genocide and the structural changes to genocide. So if for example, Chechnya is an example of the Committee of Conscience from the Holocaust Museum, that's a potential genocide. So we definitely want to look at genocide as an issue. And just like we were able to abolish slavery and piracy in the high seas, hopefully soon we can end genocide as we know it.
You think never again can ultimately stick? It doesn't have to be a permanent feature of human interaction?
I do. If there's a will, there's a way, and we're seeing it happening right now in Darfur.
Samantha Power, we've just got half a minute here. Relief to have these kids at your side?
Yeah, well, now that I'm in Washington, you know, I see all these delegations, the farm lobby and the rifle lobby, and it's just such a relief to have a group of people who want to do nothing other than stop genocide. That's my kind of lobby.
not for subsidies for a barrel of anything, but for people right now in Darfur. Samantha Power, professor of human rights practice at the JFK School of Government at Harvard, author of A Problem from Hell, now working for U.S. Senator Barack Obama as a foreign policy fellow. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
And Mark Hannis and Rebecca Hamilton with me here with the Genocide Intervention Network. Thanks to both of you, and good luck with your work. It's inspiring to see you pick up the up the torch here. We wish you well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Hope you
Thanks
become a
member. Thanks for having us. Yes, sign up.
Sign up is the word. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.